philosophy.
My new philosophy, Miss B, I'm she.
Look, C,
a D, a D. Well, why are you telling me?
And that's my new philosophy. That's
your Hello new and welcome philosophy. To Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, September 25th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Matt Tamanini. Matt is Broadway World's senior TV and film critic and the host of Some Like It Pop podcast, which is available on iTunes and Stitcher. You can connect with Matt on Twitter at BWWMatt. With us today, we have a very special guest. Andrew Lippa is with us via Skype. Andrew is not only the president of the Dramatists Guild Fund, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, but he has also written a few little ditties that some of us might have heard before. A Drama Desk nominated music and lyrics for Big Fish, the Tony nominated music and lyrics for the play The Addams Family, the Farnsworth Invention. His new song Evil Like Me is from Disney Descendants. Has been heard by 25 million people around the world, probably more by now. I think that's an old number. So, Andrew, thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and joining us. We really appreciate it. I don't want to make a list of your work because we're going to touch everything here. So everybody sit back. We have a 6 or 7 hour podcast here. So, Andrew, thank you for getting up and talking with us. Our main topic this morning is really to talk about your work as the president of the Dramatists Guild Fund. So explain to folks who are listening what the Dramatists Guild Fund is.
Sure. The Dramatists Guild Fund is the charitable arm of the Dramatists Guild. The Dramatists Guild is the organization who represents composers, lyricists, librettists, and playwrights around the United States and supports and defends the rights of copyright and the protection of minimum standards for dramatists around the country. The fund is a public charity. We only became a public charity 5 years ago, though we're a 52-year-old organization. And we are the part of the guild that operates the majority of the educational programs and a lot of granting and emergency granting for writers who need help at certain stages of their career. One of the taglines for our organization is helping writers at every stage of their career. And we are very committed, I personally am very committed, to helping dramatic writers across the country, not just in New York City and in major cities, but anywhere people are writing plays or musicals.
So a person like you who is certainly just pumping out theatrical work all the time, how do you balance your time between creating new works for yourselves and dedicating time to the fund?
Just a second. Let me finish notating this musical score and I'll get right
back. I see. I see what you did there.
I have grown into someone, and I chose those words particularly. I have grown into someone who cares deeply about service, about giving back, and about the opportunity to help others. I'm an ordained interfaith minister. I went to seminary for 2 years in my mid-40s. And now do all kinds of things related to ministerial life. I was the minister in particular at my nephew's wedding this summer, for example. And I also believe that after being the beneficiary of the Dramatists Guild and the work it does for 30 years or 25 years of my career, it was time for me to give back in as substantial a way as I could. So I try my best to carve out time. In fact, when the DGF came to me, the board came to me and asked me if I would consider being president, I did say I travel a lot. I have 3 new productions next year. 2 of them are in England. So I said, I travel a lot. So if it's about FaceTime, I'm not sure I'm the guy to do it. But if you want somebody who's passionate about the programs and who's willing to speak about it and who can do a lot of the other work and show up when I can, and they agreed to that. They understood that I was a busy artist and that was actually what they said they wanted. So it's turned out to be a good fit. We're heading into my second year of a four-year term, and we're seeing an incredible amount of growth in the organization. And what's exciting is we're starting to attract some really exciting people to our organization who are getting wind of what we're doing. So not only are we attracting great theater writers who many of us listening on this program will know, but we're trying to reach out to people who are theater writers but also known as other things, because they help attract new potential funders and new ways for us to reach out so that we can actually grow the organization. So for example, on October 13, we're doing a private event at someone's home in Manhattan, and our guest is Steve Martin. And Steve, as you know, is also a playwright and songwriter, in addition to all of the other things that the public knows him for. And I'm thrilled I am available for that one. And I'm going to be interviewing Steve Martin, who is one of my my writing and comedic heroes. So I can't wait for that event.
All right. Now, not financially. I'm not asking financially. But during your career, did you ever have to call in the Dramatists Guild to help you in any way with perhaps a production that was going on, anything like that?
Oh, for sure. And I'm fortunate I didn't have to call on them financially. The truth is, there was a period where I got down to $700 in my bank account, and I was very fortunate. I had a job as a music director a month after that experience, and I started to build up the coffers. But many writers don't necessarily have the opportunity to do dramatically tangential jobs like being a music director. I don't mean to speak down to music direction, but you know what I mean? It wasn't writing, it was right next to writing. I got to be involved with making a new thing. The Dramatists Guild helped me with a contract with a major producer. We were running into some bumps along the road, and I will always turn to the Guild, and I will always have my agent turn to the Guild. And what's magnificent about being a member of an organization that boasts Stephen Sondheim and late Edward Albee and many others as its members is that there is this incredible sense of community, and we are called a Guild. And I feel in a way like I'm a cobbler or I'm a tanner. You know, I have been trained by these great writers, and I have learned from many of them, both directly and indirectly. And now I am part of a guild of people who are passing down a tradition and allowing me to do it. And now I'm trying to do that for the next generation. And there is something incredibly powerful and wonderful about that.
Well, you've done a lot for the next generation in terms of what you've written, because every time I turn around, I see there's a production of The Addams Family, a big fish somewhere in this country. So that's really quite great. But I want to ask about The Wild Party, which you may recall I wrote that 14 seconds into seeing it, I knew I had to see it again. I was very, very fond of The Wild Party. And of course, anybody who can write a showstopper like the one you wrote for Alex Corey certainly shows that he's a Broadway baby. Now, the question becomes, when you were writing The Wild Party, did you hear that Michael John Lacusa was writing it? Did the same thing? Did you start first? Did he start first? Do you have any idea who started first?
Well, I'm going to start first and say thank you, Peter, for such kind words about The Wild Party. It is wonderful to be some in the ranks of people who make things that people want to constantly remake. And I get great joy at seeing people continually do productions of The Wild Party. I started writing that show 20 years ago. Wow. And it is alive and well. So that's an exciting thing. In terms of the fact that there was another musical based on the same subject matter, this is the first I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm here for, Andrew.
I'm really
fill you in. I see.
Shocked.
Okay.
The answer is simple. The poem was republished in 1995 with new drawings by Art Spiegelman, and it was that version of the poem that that reached both Michael John and me through however it reached us. And neither of us knew about the other. I didn't know about the other Wild Party until I was well into the process of developing it at the Manhattan Theater Club. And my producers at the time were and continued to be all the way through production, said, "We're doing your show and that's that." So the rest is for people to talk about how queer that all was and unusual timing, etc. And who knows? It may in the long run it may have helped us rather than hurt us. So nobody knows, and it's really ancient history. And my show has had hundreds of productions in multiple languages around the world. So it's been a great blessing.
Sure has.
So you have. You mentioned that you're traveling a lot coming up, and one of the planks of the Dramatists Guild Fund is to put writers at center stage along with the educational and financial productions and programs. You are focused on bringing attention to writers across the country and highlight part of their parts of their collaboration. So you have this all these programs around the United States. Can you tell us briefly about some of them and what types of things you're hoping to accomplish with that?
Absolutely. To start with the first one that came to mind because you were talking about the notion of going around the United States is called the Traveling Masters Program. And our Traveling Masters, we send out playwrights, composers, and lyricists to places all across the United States. Steve Flaherty and Lynn Ahrens just went to Hawaii last year. We sent Doug Wright down to Texas, where he's from. We've sent I've gone to Michigan, where I'm from, and spoke to 1,000 students as part of the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival, and did a lecture. And the opportunity is to get in front of young people and or writers in other locations where there aren't large theater hubs, and to talk to them about making theater and how we got where we got, that we're just people. You know, sometimes I remember when I was a kid, I had posters on my wall from shows I admired. And years later, I met those people. I met some of those people. I remember specifically, this is very funny and strange, but Otz Munderloh. Do you guys remember Otz?
Sure.
He was a sound designer, right? I don't know what he's doing these days, but he was a sound designer on Patti LuPone's concert act on Broadway in 1995. And I was hired as the associate music director, and I played the keyboard on stage. And that's how I got to know Patti. And it was my first big Broadway show. And I went up to Otz and I said, you were on my wall in high school. Mm-hmm. And so the opportunity with Traveling Masters is to take people whose names are known and whose work is known and to bring them to people who otherwise wouldn't get the experience of learning from them firsthand. Our Fellows program is something I'm very excited about growing, which is what we are doing. We are one of the premier, again, Lynn Ahrens and Steve Flaherty, they founded this program over 10 years ago. And we are one of the premier places in New York City bringing in playwrights and composers and lyricists who work together, not necessarily writing a piece together, but they work in a laboratory environment together where they present scenes and they present songs to professionals. It's guided by Michael Corey, the wonderful lyricist Michael Corey, and Larry O'Keefe, the composer and lyricist Larry O'Keefe. And the two of them run this program. It's a year-long program where we accept younger writers, and then we nurture them beyond our doors. We try to get them opportunities to develop their work at other partner organizations. And that's one of our goals, is to continue to grow a laboratory where young people can come, learn from masters, have the opportunity to write things in a safe environment and present them in a safe environment, and then further not be thrown out into the world and say good luck, but to continue the relationship so that we can say, hey, how can we help you get to the next step? How can we help you self-produce? How can we help you get connected to a developmental organization so that your work can actually be seen and be seen in as good an environment as possible so that you have a potential for production?
All right. Now, since we're dropping names, let's drop Christian Chenoweth's name, because you were an important building block in her success. Charlie Brown, of course, you wrote that song for her that certainly was very helpful in getting her Tony Award. No question about that whatsoever. How did that all happen? How did you get brought into Charlie Brown?
I got brought into Charlie Brown in the summer of 1998. My recollection is that Janine Tesori recommended me to Michael Mayer. I had done a show with Janine the year prior at the Bay Street Theater. I was the music director of a piece that she had put together about Comden and Green, a Comden and Green compendium that she put together with David Ives and Phyllis Newman. What's so wonderful is next year is the world premiere of my musical, The Man in the Ceiling, which is going to be at the Bay Street Theater. So I love that 20 years later, I'm going to be working at the same place where I pretty much got my start. Mm-hmm. And Janine recommended me to Michael Mayer, who was directing Charlie Brown. Michael said that Kristen had they wanted to cast Kristen. I had just gotten to know Kristen because the prior year she had done a reading of The Wild Party when we did it at the O'Neill. And I called her up and said, hey, they're suggesting I write a song for you. And she was deciding between doing Charlie Brown and doing a different show. And after the discussion we had, she said, you know, I think I'm going to do the show with you, Lipa. And you go ahead. You write me that song.
Yeah.
And
did you just do a Kristen Chenoweth?
Well, tiny little bit, yes. Lipa.
Tiny, no pun intended. Tiny,
yes. There's nothing really tiny about Kristen. It's just her height. And Michael Mayer had a few strips that he pulled from the Charles Schulz vault of Sally Brown saying, that's my new philosophy. There were three or four of them, and he thought this might be a good idea for a song. And I spent a few days working on it, showed it to him, made some revisions. We showed it to Charles Schulz, which was pretty cool, who approved it. And then we put it in the show. And one of the things I will never forget is that the first performance at the theater, we were at Northlight Theater in Skokie. First performance, Kristen sang that song and she got to the end on my new philosophy button and threw her finger in the air. And it was about 45 seconds of screaming and applause. And those of us working on the show who were standing in the back looked at each other and just sort of went, well, that works. You know, it was like, that's good. And that was the consistent response that Kristen got. And that song and her role and the way she played that part, all these things are combinations of elements. I often feel the song is 50% of the job and the performance is the other 50%. So Kristen and I make a good team.
Indeed.
Well, Andrew, you talked about all of your shows being played around the country and around the world. You talked about all the work that the Dramatists Guild Fund does around the country. But you, as a performer, are also traveling quite a bit, whether it's with I'm Anne Hutchinson and I'm Harvey Milk or Life of the Party. You're getting up on stage and performing in some of your works, as well as with some other really talented performers, including Kristen. Has it always been part of what you wanted to do to not only write shows but perform on stage as well in them?
When I was 16 years old, I would play, and the money kept rolling in from Vita, and I would try my hardest to sing that double high G in my head voice, and I wasn't quite ready for it at 16, but I'm sure I overacted the hell out of it and wore out the shag carpet. And I have always wanted to be, and always have been, an actor in some way or other, and made a commitment to my writing career some time ago that was what I would exclusively focus on, and also made the commitment that when I saw the fruits of some of that labor, I would return to my acting career. And so the past three or four years, we did I Am Anne Hutchinson, I Am Harvey Milk this April, and I'd love to brag a little, but that mm-hmm. production got rave reviews in the Washington Post and in Opera News. And one of the things I was most moved and excited by was the rave in Opera News about me as a performer and singer, and that I was treated as an equal artist to my friend Kristen. And that's just crazy in a way. And our friend, again, this is name droppy, I know, but our friend Renee Fleming, who's been very supportive of this production and has been a real friend to us. Renee has been also deeply supportive of my singing. And so I decided at 51, I'm not going to stop. You know, I decided I'm going to keep going, and I love doing it. And in fact, in The Man in the Ceiling, I play the role of Uncle Lester. So I will be performing in my new musical in the spring of 2017. So coming up, really. And in addition to I Am Ann Hutchinson, I Am Harvey Milk, which I can't announce what's happening next, but it's going to be soon. And I just finished a run of The Life of the Party, our U.S. premiere of the show we did at the Chocolate Factory in London. And we have future plans for that. So at the moment, my acting career is getting in the way of my acting career. And and I'm delighted. And I'm delighted. And I do feel the clock ticking in a certain way. You know, doing 8 shows a week is hard if you have a big role in the show. And I'm writing myself big parts, so no one else will cast me.
Are you sleeping with the writer?
Yes, I'm sleeping as the writer.
Yeah. Well, and I'm interested about the Man in the Ceiling. I know for some birthday when I was a kid, I was given an autographed copy of this book. So when I first heard that you were doing it, I think at a reading in the spring or something, or maybe I heard of it before, I was really excited to think about how this could be musicalized and dramatized. What was the process of going through turning this kind of beloved, I would say it's a children's-ish book, but turning this into a musical, because it's something that it's an important part of my childhood.
Well, I'm delighted that it's an important part of your childhood. It's an absolutely exquisite story. What I find – one of the amusing things for me is that when I did the first reading of The Wild Party in the summer of 1996, a friend who worked in a bookstore suggested I read The Man in the Ceiling because he thought I might like to turn it into a musical. Well, The Man in the Ceiling is about a 180-degree turn from The Wild Party as you could possibly get in terms of tone and in terms, you know, it's certainly G-rated compared to the R-ratedness of The Wild Party. It wasn't until 2000 that I got in touch with Jules Feiffer, and Jules came to see The Wild Party. We had a wonderful chat, but he was planning on making it into a musical with another composer. And I tried to get him to change his mind, and he wouldn't. And I called him once a year. I figured, what the hell, if Jules Feiffer hates me, I'm going to call him once a year and ask him if he's working on The Man in the Ceiling. And he kept saying he wasn't working on it, but that I couldn't do it. And over a 5-year period, I hocked him enough so that he finally let me pitch it. And I did. We had a short development flirtation with our friends at Disney Theatrical, and it didn't turn out to be the right fit for them or for the show. And really rancorless. It was a wonderful experience. It just wasn't the right fit. And the show sat for a while until Jeffrey Seller read it. And Jeffrey has come on board as producer and director. Jeffrey and I used to direct shows together.
Wow.
When we were in college and when we first came to New York City, Jeffrey directed shows. I was the music director, and Jeffrey and I grew up together. So there's a certain amount of joy in doing this. There's a lot amount of joy in doing this with Jeffrey. And in particular, one of the first shows in high school that Jeffrey ever did that I was a stage manager on was called Feiffer's People, which was a compendium of Jules Feiffer's work. And that's how we were introduced to Jules when we were 15 years old. And so to work with Jules has been a joy. This show has been a great existed over a pretty long period, in part because we changed who we were working on with, and in part because it's tricky to distill this kind of show and this kind of book and try to figure out how to do the comic book element and how to not make it too big. That's one of the things we've learned, is that the smaller the show has gotten, the bigger it's gotten. And that's a wonderful irony that I hope people will feel. The emotions of the show have come out so much stronger the less number of people there have been in the show. So when we did a reading last summer, we had 9 people. When we did a reading this spring, we had 6. And that turned out to be the magic number. It allowed for more imagination and more opportunity for all the actors to play. One of the things is the actors are all playing characters other than themselves. And so they play the character they play, but they also play characters out of the boy's imagination. And we're delighted that we're going to be doing this at Bay Street. We had a wonderful reading there, and it's a great space to do a show in. So I'm excited about this show.
A few things before we let you run for the morning. You know, that Jeffrey Seller guy, he's not had very many successes, so no, you should think about that before you get deeper into it.
A little show called Hamilton, I think, is one of...
Oh, that Rand Hamilton, you know, he doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
So, a quick talk about the Big Ten. So, so you are from the University of Michigan, and I am
Porter, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Irving Berlin. No.
Different Big Ten.
Oh, the other Big Ten.
I know.
Matt's from The Ohio State University, and I'm from Penn State University, where we focus on academics and not football these days. So, you know, what is in the water in Michigan that so many amazing musical theater talents and theatrical talents and artistic talents are coming out of there?
Well, just for equal time, please. I went to the University of Michigan, go blue. And I think that a lot of it has to do with the fact that the University of Michigan is one of our greatest institutions in the country, let alone from the arts standpoint, but it is one of the great universities in the country. Money Magazine just listed us as the second best university in the country after Princeton. And the university itself is a real draw. The School of Music, Theater, and Dance is a real draw. And in particular, Brent Wagner, who just retired, has led the program there for 32 years. And the musical theater program has been focused primarily on performers. But out of that program have come Jeff Marx, David Kirschenbaum, Paskin Paul, Andrew Lippa. I'm probably missing some people, other writers as well, although they don't have a musical theater writing program per se. And I think another part of it is there's a real sense of Michigan. I don't know why, but Michigan has the largest alumni network in the country. The largest number of people who graduated from a university went to the University of Michigan. And I think in the music school, and in particular the musical theater program, there is an enormous sense of community and continuity. And when we did this, we did a huge concert to celebrate Brent Wagner at the August Wilson Theater in May. And I was fortunate enough to be the opening number. And we did the opening number from Big Fish called Be the Hero. And one of the things I didn't realize we were doing until we got into it was that I was at the piano and then stepped into the number as a dancer and participant in the number, but all the other people in the number were the current students at the university. And it was this wonderful intergenerational, it's hard to remember that I'm 51 sometimes, but it was this, I'm old enough certainly to be, most of their parents are around my age, if not younger. And so it was this great example, a visual example of seeing this older person who started when Brent Wagner started and these young people who are still there after he leaves. And there is a real sense of family and community at the University of Michigan. And I think that's what helps promote the brand, as it were. And a lot of people are interested in going there because of it.
And then the student organization Musket, the University of Michigan student-run musical theater organization, did Big Fish, and is that kind of awesome for you to hold up a mirror there and go back and visit and do things? Did anybody there ever tell you you're never going to amount to anything, and you'd be like?
No. My challenge when I was a student was that I was interested in many different things and seemed to have aptitude for them. And so the issue of for me was focus. And I spoke to that earlier about focusing on my writing career before allowing my acting career to happen. But that was my issue, because I discovered writing and I started to get really much better at playing the piano. I was studying voice full time. Voice was my major instrument. I wanted to be in shows, but I also wanted to music direct shows. And I studied composition with William Bolcom. And I think one of the things about going back in March this year and seeing a student run production of Big Fish, it's a thrill. People have asked me in the past. I just did a masterclass in California, and one of the parents asked me, why do I do this? And I said, well, I don't have children of my own, and I feel so thrilled that these young people love the art form I love, that they cherish the art form I cherish, that they want so much, so desperately, so passionately to learn about it, to be part of it, to hear from people who make it and who have existed in it for a lot longer than they have. And when I get that opportunity to come back to the place where I was I was conceived, as it were, at least where I was conceived creatively, and to share it with young people, it was a thrilling experience. And one of the great experiences of that was Coach Harbaugh's young son played a role in Big Fish, in that production. And the coach, I don't know the coach very well, but I wouldn't expect the coach to be a great musical theater fan. But it turns out that his son had done a production of Big Fish in high school, and that the coach and his son used Big Fish as a big bonding experience for them. And so by the time it got to Michigan, the coach was at every performance. He did a little cameo appearance in one scene in the show, and it got covered by all the major newspapers in Michigan and online. It was a huge response online, and the coach himself tweeted about it several times. And it was really wonderful. I got to take pictures with him and meet his wife. And it was really great to see that the coach of this major football team was also interested in musical theater. And I told other people, look, I go to football games, so why shouldn't it work the other way? And it was a delight, and I was really grateful to him because he put a real focus on these students and a focus on musical theater at Michigan, and it was a real help.
Just the Venn diagram between our listeners and football fans is not very large. So Jim Harbaugh is the head football coach of the University of Michigan, which is probably, one of the most important football coaches in the world.
Be careful, James.
I was very careful not to step on the Ohio State. I said one of the most important football coaches in the world.
This would be a referendum on football in college. I thought this was a musical theater chat.
Yeah. And I want to point out that Jim Harbaugh is 52 years old, and you mentioned that you're 51. So you two are contemporaries.
He was on the team when I was a kid at school. Yeah.
So absolutely. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for spending so much more of your time than we had planned on taking your time this morning. I really appreciate you being so generous with that. Andrew Lippitt is the president of the Dramatists Guild Fund. He does some other stuff that we will link to, we really want to know about the whole I Am Harvey Milk stuff. So please, after we disconnect, you'll tell us the dirt on it, right? We want to know what's coming up, because so many listeners saw it in New York and in D.C., and gave us wild reviews. In fact, we had a listener that phoned in and gave us a review from the, I think it was Virginia, not quite D.C., that you had done something in.
It was in Bethesda.
It was in Maryland. I knew it wasn't in D.C. proper. So, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk with you soon.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wish a bolt of lightning would hit. Out of the blue, out of the blue. A magic lamp that suddenly lit. How many years have passed me by? Wishing, waiting. How many hopes have left me dry? Just downright irritating. How many men have I been through that rotten bottom feeding zoo? They keep repeating, leading me to out of the blue, out of the blue.
Peter, you got down to the Soho Playhouse where you saw Chip and Gus. Tell us, what is Chip and Gus?
Well, I'll tell you, it's one of the damnedest things I've ever seen, and one of the most impressive things I've ever seen. It's simply about two guys who are bonding. They're friends of a sort when they start. When they finish, they're much more friendly. They've learned a lot more about each other. They've come to care more about each other. Fine. But here's the thing. During the entire 90 minutes, virtually the entire 90 minutes, they're playing ping pong. I mean this. There's a ping pong table on the table, and they're playing while they're talking. And they're both terrific. I mean, it's amazing to watch them play ping pong while they're doing all this talking about their lives, about their past, about their potential futures, a little bit of criticism of each other here and there, not just about ping pong, but about life in general and how they've handled their lives. And perhaps if one or two has a secret, is it time to divulge it while they're playing the game? Amazing, just amazing to watch them do this, how they learned it. They wrote it. They learned it. They're doing it while playing ping pong. It's amazing. They, by the way, turns about John Aleen and Christopher Patrick Mullen. And to watch them is something you just have to see. Now, this is part of that New York International Fringe Festival. And now what we're having are essentially, you should pardon the expression, the winners of the New York International Fringe Festival getting a chance to air their wares to more people because they're the ones that have been the best received. I hadn't really heard about this property until it was named a winner. And under those circumstances, I said, oh, let me go. But I was completely captivated, not just by the ping pong, by the way, but by the play itself, by the natural dialogue, by the way that these guys delivered the natural dialogue. I think that they're among the finest performances of the season. So I would say it's going to be around, I think, for a few more weeks. In repertory, of course, and with a million other shows. But nevertheless, try to find it. Chip and Gus, that's, by the way, one word. There are no spaces between Chip and Gus, one word, because they do become a unit as time goes on, even though they don't start out as one. I guarantee you you'll be impressed, and I guarantee you'll laugh a great deal. It's very, very funny. So, the Soho Playhouse, Van Dam Street, the E-train takes you right there. Make sure you see Chip and Gus.
Peter, do they kind of venture into the whole subculture of table tennis or ping pong?
No, not at all.
So it's just that it just happens to be that they're having this discussion over ping pong?
They just meet every, I think, Tuesday or Thursday night to play ping pong in some bar in, I think, Schenectady. I don't know. Do you mean like ping pong is really accelerating?
Ping pong is like a whole subculture that there are table tennis clubs all over Manhattan and things like that. And there's this whole subculture of people that really their life revolves around, you know, work and ping pong.
That's not quite this. I understand what you're saying, I'm not surprised to hear it. But this is just two guys who are passing time. They do meet with other people to play every now and then, but I don't think it's really an important part of their lives per se. Although the way they play, you can tell that they've been doing it a long time. It's just amazing how good they are. I mean, and while they're coming out with dialogue, and they never pause. I mean, wouldn't you think that in a play like this, where you're playing ping pong, you would get so wrapped up in the ping pong game that you'd forget your lines? Or, you know, none of that happens. It really is something to see. And again, the type of thing that works best in the theater. If this were a movie, you'd think, all right, you know, the take 42, you know, that type of thing. It doesn't work that way at all. I mean, they have to continue doing it. And to watch go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I would assume that means that they both are really good at it already.
I have no doubt.
I don't think they cast these two guys and said, hey, guess what? You know,
they wrote it. They wrote themselves. They wrote it for themselves. So, yes, I am sure that they were damn good ping pong players before they put pen to paper. But still, there are times when you see that ball going over that net and you say, oh, they're never going to get that one. And they do. And they,
you know, you talk about these are two guys who put pen to paper and wrote this together. I would love to know that moment right before they decided to put pen to paper.
I agree.
Were they playing ping pong and they were like,
really?
I was writing plays. Hey, I'm thinking about writing a play. Hey, you know, we should do this together. And bam.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
If this moves on, we'll see if we can get them on to interview them. Because I bet you that that's a really interesting story.
I do too.
That moment before.
Yeah.
All right. So both of you got a chance to see A Taste of Honey. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with A Taste of Honey?
Well, this is a play from 60-61. That's not fair. It was on the Broadway season 60-61, but it actually was a British play that was produced a couple of years earlier in London. The astonishing thing about it is that it was written by an 18-year-old girl, Shalane Delaney, who kept writing but never quite had a success that remotely approached this one. It really was one of those one-hit wonder type things. And, I mean, she did work. And the movie Charlie Bubbles, which a lot of people know simply because Liza Minnelli was in it, is her work too. But all things considered, this was the big one. Now, a lot of people are going to say, oh, it's so dated. Again, please don't do this when you go see a play. What you have to do is imagine yourself back in 1958, and you're sitting with this stiff upper lift London audience, and they are confronted with what was then called miscegenation, meaning black and white relations. A homosexual is put on stage, and there's even a mention of abortion. Think how many scandalized gasps and moans you would have heard around you, and who knows, perhaps you would have even contributed to a few of them. But, you know, even 2 years later, when the play opened on Broadway, you know, almost 50% of the states were banning marriages between blacks and whites. So a kiss between a young black man and a young black woman would have still sent shocks, or I'm sorry to say, shudders through many of the audience members. And, you know, they wouldn't have been too hospitable to homosexuality or abortion either. But wow, I mean, while the play may have seemed sensational back then, in the real meaning of the word sensational, it doesn't come across that way now, but you really have to put yourself in that mindset to understand that. What's really wonderful is seeing how prescient Shelley Delaney is, because here is the girl, Jo, who is living with her mother in a woebegone flat. They seem to go from one apartment to another with great regularity, probably because the mother doesn't pay the rent. And the thing is that every apartment they go to seems to be worse than the one before. So Jo is very critical of her mother, who is described in the script, by the way, as a semi-whore. That's exactly how she's described in the stage directions. So, but you know, you would think that an 18-year-old girl writing about an 18-year-old girl, Jo, and her mother, Helen, though it's always Ellen because it's Cockney. you would think that an 18-year-old girl writing about an 18-year-old girl would be on the 18-year-old girl's side. And yet she's very, very fair to the mother. The mother seems to be making the best of a bad situation. She's not discouraged that she's moved into this place. She's trying to do the best she can, while the girl is nonstop critical. And I thought that was very good, that an 18-year-old girl could see the mother's side of it and take the mother's side of it to that point. but later, Jo meets Jeffrey, who well, let's use the word accuses, because it really came across that way, of being homosexual, and he doesn't want to admit it. And who can blame him in London at that time? This was an imprisonable offense. So, you know, he really downplays it for the longest time. But what's really so compelling about this play is the relationship between them. And we have seen so many relationships since then between a gay man and a straight woman that really involves love. As Ed Kleban wrote in wrote the song, and it turned up in a class act, that it's the next best thing to love, but it really is love too. And that's what they have. And whether or not they'll be able to keep it is another story. The direction by Austin Pendleton, I think, is good, but I want to point out one thing, and that is the actor who plays Jimmy, the black young man who turns out to be Joe's lover. And what I liked very much about the direction is that he did not come across to me, anyway, as somebody who was just out to get laid. It wasn't that at all. The actor Ade Otakoya really seemed as if he cared about the girl. Now, one thing that happens is he's going away for 6 months, and we never get to that point, that six-month point in this play. And it's entirely possible he will come back and love her. We don't know. That's an unanswered question. But the way that Austin Pendleton directed this young man, I think he's coming back. So if everybody disagrees with me, I understand. But that was the impression I got. The two leads are very, very good indeed. They really deserve a lot of credit. Rachel Butchen is the person who plays Helen, or Ellen, if you will. She gets involved, by the way, with a guy who wants to marry her. Bradford Cover plays him, a very good actor. He says, you can't afford to lose a guy like me. You know, I mean, and he's got one eye, by the way. suggesting that the man shortage we've heard about America for the last half century was already happening in 50s London. But Rebecca Brockman is the one who plays Joe, and it's a role that's really been made for a girl who is very plain looking. Now, whether or not if I saw Rebecca Brockman at a party, I would want to give out with a wolf whistle, I don't know. But she's able to de-beautify herself down to make her look like this really woebegone person who nobody knows the troubles I've seen. So they're both very, very effective, and but. It was so interesting to be in that audience at the Pearl Theater, because the Pearl gets an elderly audience, no question about it. And there they were sitting there, and they weren't remotely shocked. Of course not. They're of the generation that came to see this play when it was first done, and nothing shocks us anymore. So it was really fun to be in an audience that was responding to the play, but not to the shock value of the play, that they would laugh when funny lines came out, all, by the way, character-driven lines, not jokes or gags. So I really was very impressed that the audience took it in the best way possible, in a ho-hum fashion, and proving how far we've come. Because believe me, I can hear those gasps in those stalls in London in 1958. I can just hear them in my ears, you know, with the whoa, you know, when some of these things came. Only, you know, with the bravado of youth could somebody do this. And Shelley Delaney really did it. And I was very glad to finally have a chance to see this hit play from the Broadway 60-61 season.
All right. Michael, what did you think?
Well, first of all, I definitely agree about the two leads who I was previously unfamiliar with, Rachel Botchin and Rebecca Brockman. And aside from their acting being so excellent, I thought it seemed to my ears anyway that their dialect work was really stellar. So brava to both of them. I was so pleased with the opportunity to see this play because it's one of those lapses in my theater education. I had never seen or read it in any form. The film was quite popular in its day, but I've never seen it. And of course, in situations like this, when I know something is coming up, I say to myself, well, you know, I can research it. I can try to find the movie. I could go get the play and read it. But I do many times like to go in cold, and because I think there's something neat about that, you know, to experience a
I agree.
An old, you know, a classic or an older play cold for the first time. So I really appreciate them doing it. There are some very odd things about the play. Apparently, the original production had these what one might call Brechtian devices in it from the beginning, at least two of them, I would say. And actually, that leads to one of my biggest problems with the play itself. It seemed like in the first scene only, at various points, Helen or Joe would turn to the audience and directly address the audience and comment about what was happening on stage, and then go right back into the dialogue. Now, first of all, I mean, it struck me as odd that they would do that at all, because the dialogue is so realistic. This is very much a kitchen sink drama kind of play, although, and in fact, you almost see the kitchen sink, but I think it's sort of behind a little partition. So I thought that was odd to mix those two to begin with, but that wouldn't be the first play to do that. So I was willing to, you know, sort of go with it. But then I'll be damned if they didn't completely stop turning to the audience and addressing them directly. So, Peter, why do you suppose that is, that she adopted that device in the beginning and then completely dropped it?
Well, not completely. At the end, she came back to it, but she did forget it for 2 hours. There's no question about it.
Was there one at the very end?
Couple, yeah. It was bizarre. And what we have to remember is that Joan Littlewood was involved with this production. And I don't know if you're going to now bring up the fact about the music, which is so bizarre, too.
Yeah.
Joan Littlewood was the one who suggested, you know, this play could use some music. So in this production, you have three guys to the side playing the famous Taste of Honey song, which indeed was written for this production. A lot of people say, oh, it probably was the theme for the movie. It never appears in the movie, which I did watch, which opens it up tremendously and gives you a lot of backstory. It's a fascinating film under the circumstances. But back to the play, the musicians then barge into the apartment to actually sit there and occasionally are recognized by the characters. Right, Michael? Occasionally the characters will look at the musicians and actually address them. Even though they're sitting on the couch, two of them anyway, the poor bassist has to stand the whole night long. But it's so bizarre to have the musicians there. But that was Joan Littlewood, who also loved Brechtian devices. So I wouldn't be surprised if she's the one who put them in at the beginning and thought it would be funny. But I agree with you. It's so bizarre that it isn't continued.
Well, yeah, the research I did, I'm not completely sure. It says – if I understand correctly, there was music in the original production, and there was a band that was part of the cast.
Absolutely,
did this part of the. But I think, if I'm correct, that the difference in this current production is that the characters sometimes actually sing with the band, and I'm not sure if that was in it. Do you think you know if that was true in the original production?
I don't know for sure, but I get the impression that they did have a line or two of song and that they were accompanied. What I don't think happened in the original production is they came into the apartment. There seems to be nothing in the script that indicates that. I think Austin Pendleton, I think.
Right, and I have to say I thought that was a tremendous mistake on his part. I didn't think this
Yeah.
This production was well directed at all. In the beginning,
guys were so bored. The musicians, you know, they didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to look. They were very self-conscious just being on stage.
Well, imagine, first of all, even if they were professional actors, being required to literally sit there for like 40 minutes at a time during scenes and not have a single line of dialogue.
Absolutely.
and just have to decide whether to look at the actors and, you know, and seem like they're involved, or one guy had his head down, you know, and they were great musicians. Don't get me wrong. They played that theme and other stuff just wonderfully. The way it's staged here is at the beginning, they're far stage right, sort of just beyond the set, almost like in back of the bed. Isn't that correct? Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And but then at one point they switch side. They walk in back of the set. They walk onto the stage and they sit on the couch. And that's the point where at several times one or another of the characters sort of seemed to be addressing them. So I just thought that was very weird. And again, these Brechtian devices, whether they're effective or not is open to debate. But the fact that they're used so inconsistently, I think, is odd. And I would love to – I'm going to see if I can do some more reading and find out exactly how this was done in the original, because I thought it didn't work very well at all here. And I do wonder why she decided – if she was going to use a side, she did them in the beginning and then, as you say, forgot about them for 2 hours and then maybe did one or two at the end. But – that said, what an extraordinary play. I mean, really, not only for its – it seemed – you mentioned dated, and I guess someone with no sense of history could look at this and say it's dated.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, to me, if I go in and it's made clear to me what period it's supposed to be and I have some sense
me
of
– too.
You know.
Yeah. That's good enough for me. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the dialogue and the characters are absolutely, absolutely wonderful. I think she was an incredibly talented young woman, Shalla Delaney, if that's how you pronounce it. And I don't know Charlie Bubbles. I'll have to check that out also. Another negative about this production, I must say, although he was a superb actor, Bradford Cover as Peter. The point is made in several lines that this character, Peter, is supposed to be considerably younger than Helen. the mother. And Joe mentions it at least two or three times. And it's because that's one reason why Joe is so unhappy with the relationship. And Bradford Covert, to me, looked at least as old, if not a few years older than Rachel Botchan. So why that happened, I do not know. Somebody told me and I guess, somebody who knows what they're talking about told me that the Pearl is in some senses almost a rep company where they tend to – not a rep company, but they tend to use the same people frequently in various plays. I guess they have company members. So I guess that would be an explanation, but if it wasn't so important to the story, it wouldn't matter. I just don't know why that casting happened. I thought John Evans Reese was wonderful as Jeffrey. And yes, Ade Otukoya, as I guess you would say it, as Jimmy. And that's a very good point. I had the same impression, Peter. Yes, he was so warm and he seemed like he really loved her. And I thought he would come back. Mm-hmm. Although I don't know if it changes the end of the play, but it changes your reaction to the end of the play and what's going to happen thereafter. Mm-hmm. So anyway, what else? That's basically all I have to say about it. I'm very glad for the opportunity to see it. But I did think going before I saw it, I thought that title is really quite famous. Largely for the song, but for its place in theater history. And I thought, why isn't this done more often? And in many cases, it turns out to be because there's something problematic about the property. And so I think that in this production, I did have that sense. And I guess maybe that's why it's not done more often. But it absolutely should be seen. And I'm very grateful to the Pearl for doing it so I could see it.
Hey, Michael, you got over to Feinstein's 54 Below to see Melissa Errico. Tell us how the show was.
I really enjoyed it. She did several there this week. And first of all, not to be superficial, but she looked so beautiful. She had an incredible dress on. I think that after three children, she has gotten more voluptuous, which is a nice thing. I hate to sound superficial, but she looked so beautiful that it was – I just had to remark on it. I brought a straight friend, and he was in love. Mm-hmm. and that was even before she started singing. She sounded great. I think her voice also. I think her voice has gotten. She always had a lovely voice, but not maybe particularly large or powerful. It seemed both larger and more powerful in this case. She sang lots of show tunes in addition to other stuff, as you might imagine. Small World from Gypsy. She sang a song named Shy, titled Shy, which is billed to Frederick Lowe and Alan J. Lerner. And when I saw the song list beforehand, I thought, oh gosh, is that a mistake? Is that Shy from Once Upon a Mattress? No, believe it or not, it apparently is a very rare song that was written for My Fair Lady. Huh. and cut way, way early on. I mean, I don't even know if it ever got into it. So she sang that, Ribbons Down My Back, Children Will Listen, How Are Things in Glacamora, which is she's going to be repeating that the role of Sharon McLonagan in Finian's Rainbow at the Irish Rep. And then one of the highlights of the evening was that her guest on this occasion was Richard Troxell, with whom she starred in Do I Hear a Waltz at Encores. And Richard came out and gloriously sang Take the Moment from that show. And then they did a duet version of Do I Hear a Waltz, which I have never heard before. In the show itself, it's very important that it not be a duet. But out of context, it worked just beautifully the way they broke it up. So congratulations to whoever thought of that, whoever came up with the arrangement. Robbie Roselle was the director and Ted Firth was the musical director. And it was a really wonderful evening at Feinstein's 54 Below.
So, Michael, the Melissa Errico thing is been getting really great reviews across the board, but I want to step off the Melissa Errico thing for a second and just talk about Feinstein's 54 Below.
Yes.
Since the name change, have you seen any changes having been to shows before and after?
Well, I believe the prices have risen, but it depends on who you're seeing. And I guess the food prices have risen, but I don't usually.
But not programming from the programming perspective. It's
No. And I know I have one friend who works there, and he's still dealt directly with Jennifer Ashley Tepper. So she is still very much involved.
Great. Excellent. So, yeah, rising prices, New York City, that's not much of a story.
Yeah.
So it just happens, unfortunately.
Yes, Michael Feinstein was there at Melissa's show, the one I did. So that was nice.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
All right. And what else have we got here? You saw Ken Fallon, the illustrator, at his show. Give us a brief synopsis on that.
Yeah, he had an exhibition. I'm not sure how long it's continuing, at a place called the Atelier, which is a very, very high-end apartment building on far west 42nd Street, 635 West 42nd Street. And it's got a gallery space in the lobby. And he had a wonderful little exhibition of, I guess, mostly recent stuff. Not only recent, but some of it was recent. Ken is best known as the illustrator for many things, but for Forbidden Broadway throughout its history. So that's his style. He really does a great job. He works in color and black and white. And one of the best pieces he had there was an American Psycho, which you would think he might take the easy way out and do draw a bunch of mostly naked people, or like maybe Benjamin Walker with his shirt off, but no, he had Benjamin Walker in a tuxedo with all these little spots of red around him, and it was a really great piece. But he has older things like Betty Davis and great stars of the theater, it was nice to be there, and there was a really nice theatrical crowd at the exhibition.
All right, Matt, you got a chance to see the 25th anniversary film of the stage version of I'm so confused explaining this
it's
to people.
Okay.
I got it so wrong on Today on Broadway, but you explain what you saw.
Okay, 2 years ago to the day, on September 22nd of 2014, Cameron McIntosh had a film crew film the 25th anniversary performance of the West End production of Miss Saigon. They then aired it in United States movie theaters, and that's where it gets confusing. Every time I say I'm going to the theater to see Miss Saigon, oh, who's performing it? No, it's a movie. On September 22nd of 2016, 2 years to the day later, as part of Fathom Events, they played it in movie theaters. So it was the 25th anniversary performance around the 27th anniversary. Anyway, it gets less and less confusing as we get into it. But I tell you, James, I've been on This Week on Broadway, and I think one time you, Peter, and I talked about how a lot of these things aren't super well attended when I go, and I go to a lot of them since I live out of New York, so I do everything I can to see good theater, even if it's on a big screen. There was a lot of people at this one. I got there 20 minutes early, which usually means I can have, 4, 5, 6 rows all to myself. And I ended up having to sit in the third row with like a crooked neck up looking at the screen. But there's a lot of people there, which I think you and I predicted on Today on Broadway. We said this one will probably be very well attended, and it was. And I heard from a lot of people on Twitter from around the country in St. Louis and Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, who said they were in theaters that were similarly crowded. So that's a good sign. I'm always encouraged when people go and see these things in movie theaters.
Let me jump in for a second and say that my local movie theater on Long Island was sold out.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Could not get a ticket. Keep going.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is really something we've talked about a lot, is whether or not this will encourage people to go and buy tickets for the Broadway revival coming up this spring. I think if I was somebody who lived in and around New York City, I would have immediately, maybe even before the thing was over, maybe during one of the two intermissions, I would have gone online and bought tickets, because the production and the film quality was spectacular. What was really unique about the Miss Saigon film is that it was filmed far more like a movie than we're used to seeing. In fact, I, from what I've heard, they did reshoots so they could get close-ups up to like a year later just to make sure they had all the right angles. But when you compare it to like what Broadway HD did with She Loves Me, obviously these are two completely different animals because Broadway HD was doing She Loves Me live. But Miss Saigon made the She Loves Me presentation look amateurish by the camera usage, the quality of the film. It was just light years ahead. This looks like something that deserved to be in a movie theater. So that first and foremost was noticeable instantly. In terms of the production itself, I mean, it was Miss Saigon. It was the big spectacle you expect from that show. It was the spectacle you expect from Cameron McIntosh. And I have a feeling that it will entertain a lot of tourists in New York when it comes in the spring and then has its limited run, which I don't think will actually be limited. But the real thing to me that was of note with this, and James, we've talked about her a lot, is all the pub we've heard about Eva Noble Zeta. She was cast as Kim when she was 17, you know, hearkening back to Lea Salonga being cast as a teenager in the original production. And I got to tell you, James, it was all justified. She is fantastic. I think it's quite possible that anybody who plays Kim on Broadway will likely get a Tony nomination, but I will be gobsmacked if Eva Noble Zeta does not get one and is not a leading contender. Obviously, she's going to be up against, you know, someone named Bette Midler probably in this category, but I will be shocked if she doesn't get a Tony nomination, and I'll be even more shocked if Peter Felicia is not calling her name at the Theater World Awards in the spring, because she gives a phenomenal performance, and this was 2 years ago, like I said, when this was filmed. She's got an amazing voice. It's got all of the innocence as well as the kind of jadedness that you expect from Kim. Her voice seems very raw, but also very well trained. She's a very impressive talent. And I think the thing that really jumped out at me the most, James, you know Miss Saigon fairly well, right? Did you ever go in for this one? Is this a show you ever went in to audition for?
Yeah, many times.
Okay, I thought so. In the middle of the first act, there's this very clunky, awkward time jump that just happens out of nowhere. And there's this big song where the Vietnamese military is doing this big parade, and then we go straight into Kim. And it doesn't take but a few seconds of looking at Eva Noble Zeta as Kim to understand everything that happened to her during that time jump. And it was at that moment I was like, okay, she's more than just a pretty face who can sing. She's a real true Broadway caliber actress. And she's playing Eponine in Les Mis in London right now. But I have a feeling once she gets to New York, it'll be a long time before she leaves, because she's that good. The other actor from this production who has been announced for the Broadway transfer is John Briones. He played the engineer. He is so much fun. He's not a fantastic singer, but in that role you don't really need to be. He was funny, he was calculating, he was layered. I think he will be very well received in his Broadway debut as well. Like I said, those are the only two people from the West End production that have been announced to transfer with it, and I think we're going to be getting the Broadway casting announcements for the rest of the cast very soon, like perhaps this week. And what the rumors are is that those will be the only two people transferring with it, and I hate to say this, but I think that's probably for the best. Hugh Maynard and Rochelle and Go were quite good as John and Gigi, but nothing revelatory. They weren't to the level of John Briones and Eva Noble Zeta, but they were good. But Alistair Bramer and Tamsin Carroll were underwhelming as Chris and Ellen. They aren't the people that I probably would have cast if I was the producer, but clearly Cameron McIntosh knows Miss Saigon better than I do, so I'll defer to him. Chris was a fine singer. He got a little thin when he got up into the top of his range, but my biggest issue with him is that, man, the second act, he seemed really whiny. And that's not something that I've normally ever associated with that character. You know, in the second act, he should be a man who's been through hell and lost everything, and he's trying to rebuild his life. And that's really his hesitation when it comes to Kim and Tam in the second act. In this, he just seemed, you know, kind of like a weenie and pouty. And I didn't like that. I don't think it served the character well. I will be interested to see who they cast in that role. Tamsin Carroll as Ellen, she was fine. It didn't do anything spectacular for me. But But James, the real fun thing about this was is that, like they often do with these anniversary performances, is that they had members of the original production come out and sing, and they had the original stars, Lea Salonga, who I've got to tell you, James, if the word gorgeous wasn't created for her, I don't know who it applies to, because she looked phenomenal, and she sang a couple songs, sang Movie in My Mind with Rachel Land Go. Jonathan Pryce came out and did American Dream, and then Simon Bowman, the original Chris, came out as well, and he did a song with Lea Salonga, as well as Eva Noble Zeta and Alastair Braemar. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I don't know that it needed a second intermission before we got to the finale, but it was well worth staying, because to see Lea Salonga sing those songs again after I've listened to them so many times for decades was really, really a treat.
All right. So that's exciting. I am hoping that I'm not quite understanding this business model where they just show for one night, because certainly they can't make back even their production costs, much less make a profit in one night. But as you mentioned, maybe we are going to see this further showings announced at some other time. What is there any information about that?
Well, I not in terms of future showings, but I do know that smaller art house theaters often show them at later dates because they have different contractual agreements with Fathom Events. But during the during one of the intermissions or whatever, they did have an ad: this will be available on DVD and Blu-ray, and as well as I'm 100% sure it's DVD and Blu-ray, because people talked about it around me, but I think it also might be available on CD. I don't quote me on that, but definitely Blu-ray and DVD. So they are going to be selling it that way. The business model for Fathom Events has changed over the years, where it used to be much more of a partnership with the movie theaters. Now they're essentially renting out the theaters, which is not, in my opinion, a sustainable business model. But again, I'm not Cameron McIntosh. I'm not Fathom Events. What the hell do I know?
I was invited to a private screening of Miss Saigon on Monday evening at the Bryant Park Hotel. So it seems like, I'm not sure why they would have a private screening and invite media unless they were planning to do something else, but they haven't said what they're doing yet. So right. I'm excited to see that there was something about a DVD release, or perhaps some sort of on-demand thing could happen as well.
Absolutely.
That's great. Okay, so that wraps it up for this morning. I want to before we get to trivia, I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways you can listen to us is on iHeartRadio. iHeartRadio plays Broadway Radio broadcasts every single day from iHeartRadio. We are the only Broadway podcast on iHeartRadio, and you can get all of Broadway Radio's content there as well. You can listen to us on iTunes, as I mentioned, subscribe there, or listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, for Matt, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we talked about today, including Andrew Lippa and Chip and Gus, A Taste of Honey, the Dramatists Guild Fund, all the other stuff, the Miss Saigon movie that Matt had talked about. All right, Peter, do you have the trivia answer for last week?
Yeah, I mentioned the musicals are famous for title songs, Anything Goes in the 30s, Oklahoma in the 40s, et cetera, et cetera. So I was looking for the name of a famous musical that technically doesn't have a title song, but in a way it does, because the title is foreign, but what the title translates to in English is the name of the third song in the show. And I want to know the foreign title of the musical, the English translation, and the title of the song. And so the foreign title is Kismet, which is the Turkish word for fate, which is the third song in the 1953-54 Tony-winning musical. Jack Lechner was the first to get it, and Eric Pinnock was next. So, this week, a character named Vernon has appeared in two Tony-winning musicals. One was Damn Yankees. What was the other?
All right, and don't go to IBDB and Google it. Let's see if you know it, really. because
you can go to IBDB and you're not going to find. By the way, I don't know about you, but I can't get IBDB. The service unavailable every time I checked it for the last 24 hours. So if anybody out there works for IBDB, you might want to take a look at that.
Yeah, I run into that very often. I think IBM runs the IBDB site, and I wonder if they're doing maintenance. But I have noticed that as well.
I will point out this morning I checked it, and the desktop version does not work, but the mobile version does, which you can still get on your desktop. Just you have to make sure you go through and click the mobile version. So that is still available. I looked it up this morning.
Okay. I see that. Yeah, 503 unavailable. All right, Peter. So if you know that, please email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know on the if you are on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier, Peter Felicia, Matt Tamanini, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What? Make me laugh. Please make me smile. Please stop this song and dance for a while.
Oh,
oh no, don't make me hurt. Don't make me cry.
Don't make me cry.
Don't make me have to turn or die.
Girls would love a clown.
From now until